Open your copies of God's Word to Genesis chapter 30. Genesis chapter 30, our sermon text, will begin in verse 25. Work our way through verse 16 of Genesis chapter 31. Genesis chapter 30, beginning in verse 25, and again through verse 16 of chapter 31. People of God, this is the word of the living God. So then give heed and hear the word of the Lord. And it came to pass, when Rachel had borne Joseph, that Jacob said to Laban, "Send me away that I may go to my own place and to my country. Give me my wives and my children for whom I have served you, and let me go. For you know my service which I have done for you." Laban said to him, "Please stay, if I have found favor in your eyes, for I have learned by experience that the Lord has blessed me for your sake." And then he said, "Name me your wages, and I will give it." So Jacob said to him, "You know how I have served you, and how your livestock has been with me. For what you had before I came was little, and it has increased a great amount. The Lord has blessed you since my coming, and now when shall I provide for my own house?" So he said, "What shall I give you?" And Jacob said, "You shall not give me anything. If you will do this thing for me, I will again feed and keep your flocks. Let me pass through all your flock today, removing from there all the speckled and spotted sheep, and all the brown ones among the lambs, and the spotted and speckled among the goats. And these shall be my wages. So my righteousness will answer for me in time to come, when the subject of my wages comes before you. Everyone that is not speckled and spotted among the goats, and brown among the lambs, will be considered stolen, if it is with me." And Laban said, "Oh, that it were according to your word." So he removed that day the male goats that were speckled and spotted, all the female goats that were speckled and spotted, everyone that had some white in it, and all the brown ones among the lambs, and gave them into the hands of his sons. Then he put 3 days' journey between himself and Jacob fed the rest of Laban's flocks. Now Jacob took for himself rods of green poplar, and of the almond and chestnut trees, peeled white strips in them, and exposed the white which was in the rods. And the rods which he had peeled he set before the flocks in the gutters, in the watering troughs where the flocks came to drink, so that they should conceive when they came to drink. So the flocks conceived before the rods, and the flocks brought forth streaked, speckled, and spotted. Then Jacob separated the lambs and made the flocks face toward the streaked, and all the brown in the flock of Laban. But he put his own flocks by themselves, and did not put them with Laban's flocks. And it came to pass, whenever the stronger livestock conceived, that Jacob placed the rods before the eyes of the livestock in the gutters, that they might conceive among the rocks, or rods. But when the flocks were feeble, he did not put them in. So the feebler were Laban's, and the stronger Jacob's. Thus the man became exceedingly prosperous, and had large flocks, female and male servants, and camels and donkeys. Now Jacob heard the words of Laban's sons, saying, "Jacob has taken away all that was our father's, and from what was our father's he has acquired all his wealth." Then the Lord said, and Jacob saw the countenance of Laban, and indeed it was not favorable toward him as before. Then the Lord said to Jacob, "Return to the land of your fathers and to your family, and I will be with you." So Jacob sent and called Rachel and Leah to the field, to his flock, and said to them, "I see your father's countenance, that it is not favorable toward me as before, but the God of my father has been with me. And you know that with all my might I have served your father. Yet your father has deceived me and changed my wages 10 times, but God did not allow him to hurt me. If he said thus, 'The speckled shall be your wages,' then all the flocks bore speckled. And if he said thus, 'The streaked shall be your wages,' then all the flocks bore streaked. So God has taken away the livestock of your father and given them to me." And it happened at the time when the flocks conceived that I lifted my eyes and saw in a dream, and behold, the rams which leaped upon the flocks were streaked, speckled, and gray-spotted. And the angel of God spoke to me in a dream, saying, Jacob. And I said, Here I am. And he said, Lift your eyes now and see. All the rams which leap upon the flocks are streaked, speckled, and gray-spotted. For I have seen all that Laban is doing to you. I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed the pillar and where you made a vow to me. Now arise, get out of this land and return to the land of your family. And Rachel and Leah answered and said to him, Is there still any portion or inheritance for us in our father's house? Are we not considered strangers by him? For he has sold us and also completely consumed our money. For all these riches which God has taken from our father are really ours and our children's. Now then, whatever God has said to you, do it. And thus far the reading of God's holy word. Grass withers and the flower fades, but the word of the Lord is forever. As we come to our text this morning, we are continuing to watch the way in which God is faithful to the promises that he made to Jacob at Bethel. When he told him that he would be with him, that he would keep him and care for him and bring him safely back to the land of promise. And we are on the cusp of Jacob's return to that land of promise. And we are treated in this passage to God's faithfulness to his promise to Jacob. To be with him, to keep him, to provide for him, to care for him. We're also being treated to the maturation of Jacob as well, beginning with what we saw at Bethel. Certainly not complete, certainly will not be complete even after what's before us, but nonetheless, that process has begun and we begin to see Jacob growing in his faith. The narrative before us is often seen as Jacob being duplicitous or deceptive. Really, it's a narrative that demonstrates his continued maturation in the faith. Because we find in this text, Jacob relying on the Lord, exercising faith in God's promise to be with him and keep him, even when the circumstances, the circumstance being Laban, even when Laban and Laban's mistreatment of him makes life difficult for him. And from what we see unfolding before us, we learn primarily that the people of God are called to be righteous, whatever the behavior of the wicked. And along with that, that the people of God are to trust in the Lord to be with them and to keep them and for vindication. So turning to that first element of the text this morning, the people of God are called to be righteous, whatever the behavior of the wicked. The narrative before us begins, of course, with Jacob's request in verse 25 of the text. Joseph has been born. At this point in time, his family is complete, it's grown, he's ready to return home. Not only that, but the Lord is going to tell him that he needs to go home as well. So Jacob, having fulfilled the time that he had promised to Laban to marry Rachel and Leah, has his family full and perceives that it's time for him to go back home in verse 25. And it came to pass, when Rachel had borne Joseph, that Jacob said to Laban, Send me away, that I may go to my own place and to my own country. And he's, of course, right in the need to go back to where he came from. He's been there for 14 years at this particular point. He's been away from the land of promise for quite some time, and it's time to go back to that land of promise, to his home, to his country. And so he asked that he might leave, and he asked that his wives and his children might go with him in order that he might continue along the process that the Lord has laid before him. But of course, we know Laban's response. Laban knows that his prosperity is directly tied to Jacob. His experience has demonstrated just that, and both Laban and Jacob confirm that reality. Verse 27. He wants him to stay, if Jacob is willing to stay. Why? Because he knows that the Lord has blessed him for Jacob's sake. Which we see again a fulfillment of God's promise, that you will be a blessing as well as those who are blessed. He perceives that the Lord has blessed him for Jacob's sake, and he doesn't want to let go of that blessing because he's been made rich as a result. His desire isn't so much for the Lord, his desire is for the blessing of the Lord. And so he would have Jacob stay in order that he might continue to prosper because of the blessing that resides on Jacob. Jacob's response to Laban's request is to appeal to that very same prosperity, to tell him that I've been here and that God has blessed you because of my being here. Have I not done enough? Isn't it time that I'm able to go home? Verse 29, so Jacob said to him, you know how I have served you and how your livestock has been with me, for what you had before I came was little, and it has increased to a great amount. The Lord has blessed you since my coming. And here is his question, and now when shall I provide for my own house? He wants to take care of his family. He wants to provide for those that he has labored for these past 14 years. And this, in this response to Jacob, we find the first inclination that Jacob's faith has grown. Because we'll note what he doesn't do. He doesn't attribute this prosperity to himself. He doesn't attribute it to his own strength, to his own labor, to his own ingenuity, to his own ability to be a good husbandman as a care of the flock. The fact is that he has watched Laban's flocks and cared for them, but it is the Lord that has blessed you since my coming. Jacob is seeing the hand of the Lord and acknowledging the hand of the Lord in a way that we haven't seen him do up to this point, not even at Bethel. And so we see that his faith is growing in his God, that he is seeing God's faithfulness in his promise, that indeed God has blessed him and God has kept him and God has been with him and subsequently with Laban as well. This faith, this trust in the Lord, this acknowledgement of the Lord's hand upon him will continue through the narrative that lies before us in our text. With that, we come to the arrangement that is made. And it's interesting, we have a little bit of a comparison or a little bit of a repeat of something we find before in Genesis. In verse 31, Laban says, so he said, what shall I give you? And Jacob's response is interesting. He says, you shall not give me anything. What's he doing there? Doesn't remind you of something if you think back into the recesses of your memory and all of those months ago when we first started Genesis and we had the story of Abraham and the king of Sodom. After Abraham had set free Lot and all of those with him, the king of Sodom comes and tells him, you know, Take what is yours. Give me the people, and here, take this stuff. And what does Abraham say? He says, I won't take anything from you, lest it be understood that I got this not by God's hand, but by your hand. That somehow this is your benevolence as opposed to God's providence. And that's exactly what's happening here, and we'll see it fleshed out as the narrative continues, that Jacob doesn't want Laban to give him anything for two reasons. One, in order that it might not be said that Jacob stole from him. And two, because Jacob is going to be relying entirely upon the Lord to increase his prosperity, to care for him, as we'll see in just a moment. Lest Laban think that he had been made rich by deception or by Laban's own generous hand. And so the arrangement is laid before us. In verse 32, all the way through verse 33, Jacob will receive the speckled, the spotted, and brown sheep, and the speckled and spotted goats. And not the ones that are already existing, the ones that will be born. And of course, Laban jumps at this opportunity, and it's not too hard to understand why if we understand the nature of sheep and goats. And that is, the character traits that Jacob is claiming for himself as his wages are relatively rare color patterns. They're not something that you see normally. Normally, sheep are white and goats are black and brown. So basically, what he's saying is that I'm going to take for myself all of the rarest things that are going to be born. And you can understand Laban would jump at that opportunity. Why not? Because that means that most of the stuff is going to be his. Most of the sheep should be white. Most of the goats should be black and brown. And so, therefore, this arrangement seems to be in his financial favor. Jacob says that his righteousness will answer for him in time to come. On Laban's side, it means the opportunity to be enriched at the expense of Jacob once again, to give Jacob less than what really was his due based upon the time that he had already served Laban. And on Jacob's side, it means providing means by which his honesty and his integrity may be displayed. There's no way for him to lie and to deceive Laban concerning his wages, as it were. Laban will not be able to legitimately claim that Jacob had cheated him. He'll see the goats, and he'll see the color of the goats. He'll know the agreement, the arrangement that they had entered into, and won't be able to say that Jacob has somehow deceived him, or stolen from him, or defrauded him. Jacob will maintain his integrity, his righteousness, despite Laban's own attempts to keep him from prospering, even in the midst of the arrangement itself. Notice what Laban does. Verse 35, so he removed that day the male goats that were speckled and spotted, and all the female goats that were speckled and spotted, everyone that had some white in it. So not only is Laban happy about the advantage that he's been given, but he's also going to increase that advantage. He's going to remove all of those that are speckled and spotted from the herd and put them away from Jacob's herd to reduce the chances that there would be speckled and spotted, right? And if that wasn't enough in terms of trying to confer upon himself an even greater advantage, in verse 36, then he put 3 days' journey between himself and Jacob. Jacob fed the rest of Laban's flock. So he takes all of those speckled and spotted and streaked goats and sheep, and he takes them 3 days away from Jacob so that not only are they not there, but there's no chance that they'll even wander there. Let's see what Laban is doing. Laban is trying to take full advantage of this arrangement that has been laid before him. Be sure that there are no recessive gene-bearing sheep anywhere near Jacob's flocks. Not that he thought in terms of dominant and recessive, though. And Laban will also change Jacob's ways, wage in a constant attempt to mitigate Jacob's prosperity. That's Jacob's complaint in chapter 31, that he's changed these wages 10 times, that he's constantly been trying to change this arrangement as he sees, despite all of his best efforts, he still sees Jacob prospering. So he tries to change the arrangements, and no matter which way he tries to change those arrangements, yet still Jacob prospers. Despite all of this manipulation, despite the legitimacy of Jacob's complaint, what Jacob doesn't do is something that perhaps we would have expected him to do way back in the beginning. That he would have found his own way to deceive Laban, to be dishonest, to be fraudulent in the way that he dealt with Laban. To perhaps steal in by night and take some of those spotted and speckled sheep back to his flocks, or found some other way to manipulate. But he doesn't do that. And we'll see in just a moment what he does do. The call to us is the call that was before Jacob. That whatever treatment we receive at the hands of the wicked, at the hands of the unbelieving, and even the hands of those who profess faith, whatever ill treatment we receive, However it is that people may try to defraud us or to deceive us or to gain the advantage over us by whatever means, even as they try to oppress us in one way, shape, or form, our response is never to return in kind, to then view the deceptive and defrauding actions of others as a justification for us to then engage in the same. Rather, our response is always to be pursuing the path of integrity and righteousness, pursuing that principle of everything we do being glorifying to God as we conform to His will through the bearing of His image, and loving our neighbor as ourselves. As Jesus tells us, do good to those who despitefully use you. Jacob is able to do this because as we continue through the narrative, ultimately he's trusting in God, as we'll shortly see. And that's the only way that we can ever be in the position to, instead of returning evil for evil, instead of trying to overcome evil with more evil, to overcome evil with good, is when our feet are grounded in faith itself, trust in our God and trust in His Word, so that the circumstances of life aren't what drive our responses, our actions, our attitudes, our dispositions, but the very faithfulness of God Himself, always informing how we are then to live in light of what God has promised. So the people of God are to maintain righteousness, to seek to bear the image of God, even in the midst of those difficult circumstances brought on by the wickedness of others. And the people of God are to trust Him to be with them, to keep them, and to vindicate them. The first lesson of our text grounded in the second. But at this point in time, it's necessary to clear up some misapprehensions. Because the rest of verse or of chapter 30 seems to us to be some sort of manipulation itself, doesn't it? Right? It's a tendency to think that Jacob is being deceitful somehow. But the reality is that Jacob's not engaging in anything deceitful, even if perhaps in modern science we question the idea behind what he's doing there. What he's doing is practicing accepted animal husbandry for his day. That idea of peeling the rods and putting them before the flocks and the troughs is from a belief that vigorous sight both might make these flocks willing to conceive, but also impacted by those actual streaks in the rod, which is actually something that existed all the way through the 1800s. And Jacob isn't doing something other than what was naturally part of animal husbandry for the time in which he lived. Not only that, he selectively breeds the sheep. He breeds the strong with the strong and the feeble with the feeble in order that he might produce amongst the flocks those who would be spotted and streaked and speckled. So what he's doing here isn't deceptive at all. And it's not fraudulent. He's using the means that are available to him through the common understanding of animal husbandry. But more important than that is why he's doing it. Why is it that he's doing this? And that becomes because he's seeking to act in accordance with what God revealed to him in his dream in chapter 31. We're given after the fact of this unfolding of his plan to grow his flock, the reason why he ever engaged it to begin with. Because the Lord revealed to Jacob in his dream the overabundance that would come to him by virtue of the streaked, the speckled, and the spotted. The whole arrangement itself was providentially initiated as opposed to born out of Jacob's own thought process and pattern. As he says in verse 11 through verse 12, "Then the angel of God spoke to me in a dream, saying, Jacob, and I said, Here I am. And he said, Lift your eyes now and see. All the rams which leap on the flocks are streaked, speckled, and gray spotted, for I have seen all that Laban is doing to you. Jacob's wealth is coming from God's keeping and caring for him. The whole process that unfolds for chapter 30 is not divorced from the context of what's next. We're not supposed to learn from chapter 30 that somehow Jacob, through his use of those ordinary means available to him, procured himself in his own wisdom and his own ingenuity the greater flocks. We're supposed to learn what he learned, is that he proceeded in this pattern based on what God revealed to him. He knows that his wealth at Laban's expense did not come by virtue of craft and deception, or even the legitimate use of ordinary means, but by the Lord's fulfillment of his promise to be with him. Find that in verse 5 of chapter 31. He says, "But the God of my father has been with me." And in verse 7, "But God did not allow him to hurt me." Jacob knows why it is that his use of ordinary means has been successful. Jacob knows why it is that despite all of Laban's attempts to gain himself the natural advantage, he is successful. And it's not anything to do with him, but everything to do with God being faithful to his promise to keep him and to care for him and to bring him safely back to his land. At this point in time, it's good to probably take a moment to consider a word on ordinary means. There's something for us to learn here. As far as Jacob is concerned, he uses these ordinary means, right, of animal husbandry on things that they thought that they observed and they acted according to. You'll notice that in the scriptures, these ordinary means are never separated out from God's providence in the way that we so often like to do, as though God's ordinary means somehow are not empowered by God himself to accomplish the ends for which we use them. Ordinary means work because God empowers them to work. They're not efficacious in and of themselves just because we've gone through the particular process that we think is going to produce a result, because it just inherently does that. Nothing inherently does anything without God's operative power. We need to avoid the tendency to ignore and to forget God's constant presence and provision in the very ordinary substance of life. Beginning with what goes on in your very bodies. Every one of you here is experiencing God's ordinary means of your heart pumping and producing blood, throwing blood through your bodies, and your lungs to deliver oxygen through that blood to your bodies. There's only one reason your heart is pumping right now, and only one reason your lungs are functioning. It isn't because they just do that. It's because God upholds and sustains them that they do that. And that means then that our perspective on life, far from being able to separate God out from the ordinary, can't help but to see God in the ordinary. So as the seasons change, it's not just another change of season. It is the glory of God on display as he keeps his word to change the seasons that he upholds with the word of his power. So that the Christian's mind, when it sees the normal providence of God and watches things fall out according to their ordinary means, has nothing to say about that but thank you, Lord, for your constant faithfulness in your providence itself. There's never a moment in the Christian's life that is not ordered by God's powerful hand. There's not a moment in any creature's life that is not ordered by God's powerful hand. If you ever wonder about God's faithfulness, See his faithfulness all around you. God takes Laban's wealth from him and gives it to Jacob. And that's a consistent biblical theme. But despite the circumstances, despite what is put before us, God calls his people to have faith that he will be with them, he will keep them, and he will vindicate them. Psalm 37, verses 1 through 11, as we read this morning, are all about that. Excuse me. Psalm 37, we'll read again, particularly note verse 6 as we turn to that passage. This is the disposition that Jacob should have had, and this is the disposition that all of us should have when we are faced with the ill treatment of the world around us. Do not fret because of evildoers, nor be envious of the workers of iniquity. For they shall soon be cut down like the grass and wither as the green herb. So what is it that the Christian is called to do? Trust in the Lord and do good. Dwell in the land and feed on his faithfulness. Delight yourself also in the Lord, and he shall give you the desires of your heart. Which, by the way, doesn't mean he'll give you the stuff you want. It means he'll give you himself. If you're delighting in the Lord, what's the desire of your heart going to be? Not more stuff. It's going to be God. Just to clear that up. Commit your way to the Lord. Trust also in him. And he shall bring it to pass. He shall bring forth your righteousness as the light and your justice as the noonday. Consistent theme of Scripture is for us to continue to learn and to grow in faith, trust, and dependence upon God and adherence to his word. There's no circumstance that is to carry us off from that path. Because there is no other path that promises joy, that promises blessedness, that promises vindication, that promises God himself. And growing in faith, growing in delighting in God, growing in desiring to image him, knowing the blessedness that flows from trusting in God for everything that he is, for everything that he's revealed himself to be, no matter what may happen in the world around us. No matter the injustice, no matter the indignity, no matter the difficulty and the grief and the sorrow and the pain perpetrated upon us by others, God is faithful. God keeps. God provides. And God will carry us safely to the destination that he has promised for us. So then what do we do with what we learn of God here? As we see him being faithful to his very word, even in the life of Jacob and the difficulty that Jacob has experienced for now these 14, by the time it's all said and done, 20 years at the hands of Laban. Well, first, we learn that we are not to imitate the methods of the wicked. And that begins with not having the same goal, the same purpose, and the same drive. The wicked, the unbeliever's primary goal is the obtaining of more possession, of economic prosperity, of temporal comfort and ease. That's all they have to live for. That's all that they strive to have. And they'll use whatever means and whatever tactics to gain those things, legitimate and fraudulent alike. They will oppress for their own ends. It's written across the pages of human history. We are called to understand that possession, that economic prosperity, that temporal comfort and enjoyment aren't our chief goals and ought not to be our chief desires. Our lives are not to be lived in the pursuit of all of these temporal things as though they are sources of joy, because when we begin to do that, then we begin willing to do whatever it takes to procure them as we self-seekingly try to accumulate as though that's where joy is found. Rather, we understand that whatever possession, whatever economic prosperity, whatever temporal comfort or joy that the Lord affords, He affords us these things that we might use them to image Him, to serve Him, and to serve our neighbor. And with that perspective in mind, we should then leave off any sort of fraudulent and oppressive means of obtaining these things through fraud or inequity or oppression. Because those things malign the image of God. And they view neighbor as a means to our own ends as opposed to the object of our love. So we are called to avoid defrauding. We are called to avoid being deceptive, because these things have nothing to do with the image of God who we are to be conforming to. And they are certainly no means of loving our neighbor. The call to the believer then is to trust God. Not be envious of the wicked. To not be envious of evildoers. To not even get caught up in the evil and fraudulent ways that they obtain their possession, their wealth, and their prosperity. Or even how it seems that they get away with it. Because oftentimes, most often it seems that they're successful in their oppressive adventures, doesn't it? That's the problem that the psalmist has. He looks out into the world and he sees the wicked who are dedicating to living lives of temporal pleasure and doing whatever that they can at the expense of whomever in order that they might pursue that pleasure, are seemingly successful in their pursuit. He's calling out, why is this the case? And the answer that the psalmist has, the answer that he comes up with, is to not get hung up on that. Rather, to do these two things. Realize the ultimate end of the wicked, for one. Temporary possession and comfort is all they will ever have. In eternity, weeping and gnashing of teeth is their lot. And that's a terrible end. For all that you would possess in the however many years that you would live would last only for those few fleeting short years before they go into another's hands without you even being aware of it, whilst you spend eternity weeping and gnashing your teeth, separated from the blessedness of God's presence. How can we be envious of that, saints? How can we be envious and jealous of that end? Rather, our hearts ought to be filled with pity, with sorrow and grief, that is their end. And when we see then, saints, the oppression of the wicked and evildoers doing what evildoers do, our response isn't envy, jealousness, or even, as the psalm says, wrath and anger. It is pity and compassion and a desire to see them delivered from their very own wickedness, from their end, so that we proclaim to them the gospel of Jesus Christ. The only thing that might turn them from the pursuit of temporal pleasure, the pursuit of the eternal good that is God Himself. And secondly, we trust that the Lord will provide for us what He will provide for us. Being content with what He provides for us, rightly using what He provides for us, and properly crediting Him with that provision. It's understanding his promise. He will be with us. He will keep us. He will take care of us in precisely the ways that we need to be kept and taken care of. So that Psalm 37 becomes the anthem of the Christian heart. Trust in the Lord. Trust in his goodness. Trust that he will care for you. And beyond that, trust that he himself will be all of your delight and all of your joy and all of your peace, regardless of circumstance, whether at the hands of others or just the hard providences of life. Which is why all of that is ordained by God anyway, that you might learn the truth that nothing can satisfy and produce joy like right relationship with the God who keeps and cares for you. Nothing. In Psalm 37, it tells us there at the end of the portion that we read, the meek shall inherit the earth, and they shall know abundance of peace. They shall delight themselves in abundance of peace. Saints, it's not talking about cessation of conflict. It's part of it. It's talking about right relationship. Why is it that the believer has the abundance of peace? Because whatever he may be deprived of, and whatever he may be struggling with, and whoever may be mistreating him, he always has right relationship with God in Christ. Always. It never goes away. So we leave vindication up to the Lord. We seek to image him. Trust him to be faithful to his covenantal promises, to love our neighbor as ourselves, all grounded in the understanding that God himself is our blessedness and reward, that right relationship with him is our chief joy and the true expression of peace and prosperity. We can never be defrauded of God as our exceedingly great reward. The life of faith is patiently awaiting the full fruition of that reality as we grow closer to him to understand that. I've used the illustration before as far as rightly ordered marriages go. What's the joy of a marriage? It's the blessedness of a marriage. It's not the engagement ring. It's not the sentimental cards that you give to one another. It's not the flowers that you send, the various gifts that you give. It's the person. It's the person that is the source of blessedness and joy when rightly ordered. Children, think about that as well. It's right relationship with your parents. If you want there to be peace in your household, then you should be in right relationship with your parents. A peaceful household and a loving household, children, isn't about the toys that your parents give you. That's not what makes your household good and peaceful and prosperous. It's right relationship with your parents that produces peace, calmness, contentment, joy, blessedness. It's the relationship, saints. It's not the stuff. It has never, ever been the stuff. It's always been about right relationship with God. So then, saints, understanding that reality, when faced with the oppressive nature of living in a wicked world, because it is oppressive, and by the way, we contribute to it, that when living in an oppressive world, the answer for us is not to engage in our own oppression, but to turn to the God of promise, to lay hold of those promises by faith in Jesus Christ, trusting that he is faithful, that he is true to his word, and that he's true to his word exactly in this way, that he is joy and blessedness itself. And that as you grow into that reality, then you might begin to understand what it means when he says that I will keep you, that I will care for you, that I am, as he said to Abraham, your shield and exceedingly great reward.